This is KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. The reductionists in Congress think they know what infrastructure is: roads, highways, and bridges. They also think they know what a bridge is, but that's because they haven't read the book that we're going to be discussing on Entitled Opinions today, Of Bridges, A Poetic and Philosophical Account by Thomas Harrison, brother of yours truly and a frequent guest of this program. Open his book and you'll read about sky bridges, rainbow bridges, supernatural rock bridges, underworld bridges, sound bridges, musical bridges, word bridges, and more: angel bridges, rope bridges, sword bridges, metaphysical bridges, disappointed bridges, and yes, a lot of river bridges, but also sea bridges and man bridges. Here's a quote from Comrade Nietzsche: "Man is a rope tied between beast and overman. A rope over an abyss. What is great in man is that he is a bridge and not a goal." Take note of that, congressmen and women. If man is a bridge, why not allocate some resources to repair the infrastructure of our spiritual and cultural lives, namely the bridge that human existence always already finds itself on? One thing you'll realize if you start thinking seriously about bridges is that whoever and wherever you are, you find yourself on some sort of bridge, moving across some sort of expanse or abyss between different ontological domains. The visible and the invisible, the terrestrial and the celestial, the mystery of birth and the inscrutability of death. As Nietzsche reminds us, our human crossing does not reach a destination, but finds its end in every step of the way over a chasm. To be is to span, to traverse, to pass over. In that sense, man is a metaphor, in the etymological sense of metaphora, from the Greek metaphero, to carry over. We are a suspended movement between. Between what? Who knows? Who can say? But before I get carried away with my own bridge speculations, let me welcome to the program the author of the book that inspires them. Of Bridges was published this past April by the University of Chicago Press, author Thomas Harrison. Again, Tom, welcome back to Entitled Opinions.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
The last time you were with us, it was, I believe, to discuss the great albums of 1967, with our friend and fellow band member Jay Cadis. In fact, one of the albums released in 1967 was Jimi Hendrix's Axis Boldest Love. And in your book, you write that Hendrix's lyrics have a number of terrestrial and spiritual reference to rainbows. Let me quote you on that. "The seven colors of the song Bold as Love are personified as separate human emotions that keep me from giving my life to a rainbow like you." The term axis designates an all-knowing mystic who provides a bridge between the real and spiritual worlds. It's the end quote. I don't know why I'm starting with Jimi Hendrix, but I think that what you write in that section is directly related to some of the major themes of your whole book. Is that correct to say?
Well, yeah, no question. I was happy to be able to put Jimi into this book. As a matter of fact, twice, because I also put him later when I reference him as a bridge between blacks and whites in the rock blues rock scene. And he came up for me right at the beginning of the book with these associations with the Rainbow. You might remember that he titled his band, he had a big band at Woodstock, and he titled them the Gypsy Sun and the Rainbows. And in July of 1970, some 3 months or so before dying, he performed a filmed concert called Rainbow Bridge at a volcano in Maui, which was the House of the Sun, and therefore the entry point of the gods beyond, the abode of this sun on Earth. So Hendrix was always very interested in connecting the life here with the spirit world, which sometimes he saw in science fiction terms. So,
and which he associated often with extraterrestrial life.
Correct.
And forces. So that point of encounter, Rainbow Bridges of the volcano and so forth, that is a common motif of bridges going all the way back to antiquity, I gather. And I would say that, having, you know, read the whole book, that the main, let's say, center of gravity for your thinking about bridges is, one of them, is the relationship between the mortal and the terrestrial, the human and the divine. In other words, visible and invisible as well, spirit and matter, if you like, but two completely different ontological realms whose connections is not the easy kind of interconnectivity that you get here in Silicon Valley between, you know, the things that are belong to the same sort of plane. So what are some of the foundational stories on which the whole notion of the bridging of these two realms is based?
Well, as you know, suggesting, the rainbow is probably the archetypical bridge, and the first time it occurs to the human mind, the idea of something that joins two things that are almost infinitely separated, like the sky and the earth. So all those dualities you're talking about, life and death, matter and spirit, the rainbow seemed to be a miraculous joining of those two realms. And in the skies, of course, one imagined through the stars and other occurrences, the spirits, so that all sorts of cultures attribute to the rainbow a communicative function between those who are beyond and presumably responsible for this terrestrial life and us. It becomes the messenger. The Iris of the Greeks was the goddess of the rainbow, on which messages were sent down from the gods to us. And Norse mythology has a rainbow, which they call Asbru, rainbow of the gods, or Bifrost, the shimmering way, on which presumably the gods rode their horses down daily. And then they took up, when heroes would die in warfare, they'd take them up through the rainbow to Valhalla, the great palace where they would be immortalized and made divine themselves. There's the Navajo rainbows. Rainbow Bridge, for instance, in Utah is a rock arch bridge, which the Navajo Nation sees as the house of the holy people, there where the holy people, being the divinities, come to earth and commune with mortals. So wherever you look, you'll find the rainbow fulfilling that function, even in the story of Noah, because it becomes the covenant between God and humans. So this connection couldn't be forged any other way in a physical world except presumably through this rainbow.
Mm-hmm. Going back to the Hendrix album called Axis, Bold as Love, the notion of the axis is extremely important there too, because it's not only in that album, you talk about the Axis Mundi in different sections of the book, and it is also another kind of bridging, no? That Axis Mundi?
Yeah, because this axis, which really is not anything that somebody sees with their eyes, would be an axis that goes from the center of the earth all the way through it at the top and the bottom. So it goes through the poles from the physical world to the spiritual world, around which the whole universe was thought once to revolve. So that union, as they say, these metaphysical dualities, humans have been trying to unify them since they started to think. And so there's an intuition that there is an axis that unifies everything, and the bridge becomes one of its fundamental images, which carries through into real bridges too, because you can't really see a bridge without somehow unconsciously reflecting on how it's joining things that are naturally separate.
And speaking of real bridges, one place where the Axis Mundi appears is, you say, in the Golden Gate here in San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge, where you say that, I'm going to read from the book, "The Tall Reach of the Bridge's Red Pylons," a word deriving from the Greek word poule, gate, "creates a ladder-like ascension into the heavens, often receding invisibly into the clouds. These pylons create the impression of an axis mundi joining heaven and earth. They are combining with the horizontal axis of the bridge's platform to overcome a primordial strife between land, water, and earth." So there you get this. It's true. The Golden Gate is at once extremely vertical and horizontal, no?
And it's at the
creates a cross in that sense.
That's right. It creates a cross, which is an incredible symbol of, you know, two axes and two bridges meeting. Plus, the Golden Gate is at the furthermost extremity of the landmass. I don't know if it's the biggest, the North American continent, but it's where the land reaches the water. So the horizontal bridge unifies land and water, but those fantastically tall pylons, which almost regularly reach into the clouds so you can't even see the tops, form this joint unity that's really quite sublime.
Yeah, and you say that there, where the great star sinks into the waters, Greek and Near Eastern mythology situated the transitional point between life and death, the turn from the ordinary world to the imaginary lands. That's invariably at the westernmost, the Hesperides and the western point where the sun goes down. That's where the Golden Gate is facing there. So two things about the Golden Gate come to mind. One is the extremity, mm-hmm. and therefore it's ideally situated to bridge whatever is on the other side of where we find ourselves. And the other is this, sorry, grim statistics of continuous suicides.
Right.
Where you have a bridge that has a pedestrian walkway that is on the side that's facing the city of San Francisco and the Bay of San Francisco. And you write that there's some kind of strange attraction to the idea of throwing oneself into the water, and somehow in that gesture, with the hope of overcoming the condition of separation, individuation, differentiation that we all embodied life forms, live with, and a kind of return to a primordial oceanic oneness with all of creation. And you say that it's impossible to account for the spell such a sight can cast over those in a condition of spiritual turbulence, a sight alluding to the source of life's light and the universe beyond. And you go on to write about these people who jump, that it's related for a search for rebirth embedded in the word bedlamite, which comes from a poem of Hart Crane, no? The Bridge poem. Mm-hmm. The word itself evokes not only the famous asylum of Bedlam in England, but also Bethlehem and the birth of the word made flesh, to be drowned in order to be born again. And so you suggest that there might be a way in which some of these people who jump are looking for a rebirth in the Pacific Ocean.
Well, yeah. I mean, one can only speculate, but it's clear that they're choosing death. But the point at which they're choosing death, which is that point in the case of the Golden Gate, but by extension, any bridge over water, in a Golden Gate's case, it's very clearly the place where the sun sets. And ancient mythologies always saw the sun as being reborn every day, coming up in the east. And we've always seen life as coming from the waters and returning to the waters. Often the dead, were put in canoes and let to go floats downstream. And many cemeteries were placed on islands over and beyond water. So water is the place also of purity where you subconsciously you're trying to go back to where you came from, obviously because this individuated life, as you put it, on Earth didn't prove too well. So it's an effacement of individual identity with this kind of very sacred mythological symbolic return, which other types of suicide don't have the same way, you see.
Right. But as you say, it's not only the Golden Gate. There, you have a whole chart of how many suicides take place on bridges. It's quite astonishing. You have and it's all over the world. You know, it's not just in the West. I think some of the highest rates are in China. The Wuhan Yangtze River Bridge, 1,500 suicides in 1957. 2,300 in the year 1968.
That's when it was born. When the bridge was made.
Yes, but since then there have been.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, bridges. You know, there's something anxiety provoking about a bridge because it's suspended over a chasm.
Right. Exactly.
There's a way in which you can feel a vertiginous virtue of being on it, and it is in. I'm persuaded that it figures as it's a primary figure for a human condition, which is always suspended between one thing and another. Multiple, we're always on multiple bridges. We're at any moment in our lives. So on the one hand, there are these suicide bridges, but there's also, going back now to the Hendrix album and the title, Axis Bold as Love, this idea that love is itself a bridging, and how many bridges serve as sites for kind of romantic encounters and unions.
Well, that's right. And the link between one and the other, that is, between the tremendous anxiety, the almost metaphysical unnaturalness of walking over water on a platform without ground under your feet, that anxiety, which visits us all in life, the connection between that and the bridge as the place of love is absolutely logical. And the bridge is used as the site of love in all sorts of films and in all sorts of poems. The way the two are linked, in at least the way I link them in the composition of the book at the beginning of chapter 2, is that there's an inscription attributed to Jesus on the Fatehpur Sikri, which is a city of victory made by the Mughal emperor back in 15-something, in which Jesus is attributed the saying, life is a bridge and it only lasts a very short time. Don't build any houses on it. Prepare for the next life. That's where it seems to me that since we're on a precarious bridge for a short time, people are prompted to form unions with each other, and also, of course, unions with those who have passed before, a theme you're as familiar with as anyone because of your, you know, the dominion of the dead. The idea that the loved ones have died, that you're going to die, and hopefully you might unite with them. So the bridge becomes a place of union because of the precariousness of the life that it also symbolizes.
And in fact, in our city where we grew up in Rome, there is a bridge of Ponte Milvio, which the lovers started this
putting the locks
custom of putting locks on the bridge, and it got so weighed down that they had to start removing them, cutting open these locks night by night. But that's where the union of the lovers was symbolized, right on the bridge, no?
Right, exactly. And that took off, and it went to the Pont des Arts in France and all over the place. And I think it's very appropriate because the waters are moving and life's moving. You can't step in the stream twice. So you make a bond of love. But then ironically, you read the press. I think that 80% of the lovers who leave the locks on the bridge within 6 months have split up.
Right.
They're 17, 18-year-olds, you know. And so life is a stream in which we humans try to make something that's solid. And
we try to lock it up.
Yeah.
Lock it up.
And the bridge is that way of having the firm surface over the changeable, uncertain foundation.
Right. So there are all sorts of other bridges that, you know, your book deals with. And I'm particularly interested in the relationship between bridges and sound.
Mm-hmm.
There are actual literal bridges in the sense of the structural bridges, architectural bridges that do have a sonority, you know, a deliberately inbuilt sonority.
Right. Whether they want to or not.
Yeah.
Bridges sound because they're played by the wind.
Yeah.
So they're like harps with their cables and all of these narrow, fragile structures, you know, these poles and things, which vibrate like the strings of a guitar. So they seem to be ringing type of celestial music, if you have an ear for that. And there are many sound artists, most famous of which is Bill Fontana, who put microphones on bridges, different spots, and then sometimes it's just they play it naturally. Sometimes they edit the sounds together, and they make these sound compositions. Bill Fontana has done them on the Golden Gate and mixed them with sounds of the natural reserves nearby. So, you know, sound is always a bridge of sorts insofar as it brings to you what you often cannot see and suggests the life of the voice. I don't know, if you hear a bird chirping or an animal, in that voice you hear the life of the animal you can't see. So the invisibility of the thing that's communicated by sound underscores your distance from another creature in a way that sight doesn't. You know, sight, you're already unified within the same scene. So sound, I see that as a bridge too, as opposed to sight. And then I look at organized sound, which is the compositions I'm mentioning, but also music in the more traditional sense. As a matter of fact, that chapter, which is called Musical Bridges, focuses on the blues and tries to claim that music is always a bridge between at least two subjectivities, if not many, because there's one performer typically and many audience members. And the blues becomes paradigmatic about how it can unify different types of people. Because first it was black for black audience, then it became much embraced by white Englishmen more than white Americans. Then it came back through this modified British, you know, blues rock. Next thing you know, Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker and all these people had a primarily white audience in the U.S. within a few years. So it bridged continents and races. Music has that.
But in music, the bridge is also a technical term. So it's not correct. Just metaphorical, no?
That's right. It's a bridge passage,
yeah,
typically in composition. So
there's a bridge passage in a composition, but there's also, if you take a guitar, you have the bridge of the guitar, literally you have to elevate something so that the string is suspended
right.
Over an emptiness without which it would not sound, right?
Exactly.
So that's what the real literal bridge of instruments is all about.
Right, which is why the, you know, architectural bridge is going to be musical whether it wants to be or not, because it's going to vibrate like the strings. And they had an Aeolian harp that the Romantic poets used to use as an image for the poet. They say the poet is played like the Aeolian harp by the wind alone, through the inspiration, the flowing of the wind. So, wherever you look at bridges, even the little wooden structure on the guitar, you find all sorts of symbolic connotations.
Sure. And then, of course, going back to the religious history, cultural history of bridges, it's really quite fascinating. And you reference here a Muslim legend narrated by the Ivo Andrić, the Nobel Prize-winning Serbian author. I believe he's Serbian. No?
Well, he's Serbian, Croat. He went from one to the other. But certainly, he's really Bosnian, to be honest.
Okay.
So, in terms of the geographic provenance, let's just call him Yugoslav.
Well, he's interesting. Well, first thing, you're reminding me that region in the Balkans is one that you talk about quite extensively, because Andrić wrote the book of the bridge over the river
Drina.
And so maybe before we go to that legend, maybe you can share with us some thoughts about what that book and what the Drina River is, where is it, and what is that bridge, what's the history of that bridge is.
So the story that Ivo Andrić tells is true, which is that there was a boy who was abducted by the Ottoman Turks in Bosnia. They used to do this regularly. They used to take boys from their families around age 10, 11, and bring them to Constantinople, Istanbul, and make them janissaries. That is, they would convert to Islam, and they became functionaries in the Ottoman Empire. So Sokolovic was his name, his Mehmet, Sokolu Mehmet in Turkish. He became the Grand Vizier eventually of the Ottoman Empire, which was the de facto ruler. And I think he might have ruled 10 or 20 years, but he was very important and very enlightened. But this being abducted, which the story Andish tells of, is very moving, because all the mothers are, you know, chasing their children who are crossed over the Drina River, which is a major river in Bosnia-Herzegovina. It was so painful to him that when he became Grand Vizier, he said, I'm going to build a bridge over that river to repair the rupture inside my breast, which is also the rupture, in a sense, between Islam of the Ottomans and the Christian world across the river, you know, of those, as you say, Serbs, Croats, the ones of Europe. So he builds this fantastic bridge at Visegrad. It's got 11 arches. It still stands. It's built around 1560, perhaps. And he hoped that that would help mend the political divisions of the Balkans. Mm-hmm. But of course, the Balkan, you know, Balkanization already means to be to divide into fragments. The Balkans never, after the Turks and after World War I especially, never did get unified. And so those bridges, which were originally meant to, you know, unite, ended up being killing zones, especially in these wars of the 1990s that unfortunately followed the fall of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Yugoslav.
There are also places of ritual killings and hangings, no?
Yeah, in wartime, bridges. You might remember Fallujah in the Iraq War, where they killed, I think they strung up four or five Americans. But there's a story by Ambrose Bierce where a Confederate soldier is hung on a bridge by the Union Army in Alabama. And these were ritual sites because there were at points, these kind of metaphysical points of division and difference.
Right.
So the bridge is always divisive at the same time that it's unifying.
Right. And that's something to keep in mind, because it's, it would be very easy to just assume bridging is about all about connection. But bridges also maintain separation at the same time as they create connection. Otherwise, you would have a collapse of diversity into homogeneity, you know?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, the difference and the separation is taken for granted, and a bridge does not homogenize. It just allows for limited and even controlled passage from one to the other. So it puts them in relation, and it's dialogical. It accepts duality, and it feels it has to negotiate duality, as opposed to believing that duality doesn't exist or can simply be erased. So the whole globalization question comes up in the end of my book in a chapter called Bridged Disconnection, whereby the idea that we can just bridge the whole world, and we do with these mega bridges, which are 100 miles long, but they become tentacles of empire, whether states like China or, you know, multinational corporations that are able to get inroads this way. So the bridge should not be seen differently from what it is, and it respects the difference and keeps them apart so that we negotiate when we want to come together and how.
Mm-hmm. Good, and that's where Andrich, I'm just going to read what that myth, he said, when Allah, the merciful and compassionate, first created the world, the earth was smooth and even as a finely engraved plate. This displeased the devil, who envied man this gift of God, and while the earth was still just as it had come from God's hand, damp and soft and as unbaked clay, he stole up and scratched the face of God's earth with his nails as much and as deeply as he could. And in this act of scratching, he creates ravines and he creates rivers, and where the rivers flow. And that in response, God sent down angels to spread their wings over these chasms, allowing humans to cross them and live in harmony. So I'm quoting Andrich again. So men learn from the angels of God how to build bridges. So this would be an origin story about the that there's something angelic about bridges. But as you say, there's also this counter tradition where bridges are also demonic and diabolical. Quite interesting, no?
Well, that's the duality of the bridge, and you're absolutely right. The great effects of love and unification and so on, bringing together that Andish talks about, is very full of pathos, and it's certainly what a bridge wants to accomplish. But then there are others who see bridges as demonic. Many bridges in Europe are called the devil's bridge because they're so perilously, you know, foisted over these mountain passes that people are terrified. They said, it must be the devil who made this bridge.
Yeah.
And John Milton himself literally goes out of his way to talk about the first cosmic bridge ever made, and it was made by Satan connecting hell to earth. Because once God created earth, that earth was attached to heaven like a pendant on a chain, says Milton, and it was all harmony. And the devil, who had been at this point cast into hell, was very envious of the situation. And so he, Satan, found his way over chaos, infinite chaos in the night. And he kind of left the tracks that he made of this road and had a bridge that was built from hell to there, over which he sent his children, sin and death, to the earth. And therefore, he interfered with God's order, so that bridging is always also a risk. And that's why a lot of them are associated with, you know, collapse and death. But they're also associated with the potential to be invaded by the other and threatened.
By immigrants. Unwanted immigrants.
Right. And that's why the opposite movement is that of building walls.
Yeah.
So...
for sure. So I began with a quote from Nietzsche there in the intro, where Nietzsche was very well aware of the extent to which the church, even the church, Roman Catholic Church, is built on a notion of bridging heaven and earth.
Pontifex Maximus.
The Pontifex Maximus, the maker of bridges, is what Pontifex means, and it's a name for the Pope, no?
The supreme bridge builder, because he builds the bridge between earth and heaven.
Right, exactly. And of course, Nietzsche wants to preserve the concept of the bridge, the whole dynamic of the bridge, but to redefine what the terms of, in the literal sense of terminals, the terminal ends of the bridge. It's not no longer in Nietzsche the earth and heaven, but it's a being stretched between a present humanity and a future humanity. So how do you, does Nietzsche horizontalize this history of a more vertical bridge building in the religious tradition that he was attacking?
Well, yeah, I think he does. But, you know, it's a bit like the Golden Gate, because he has a lot of verticality, too. He always talks about self-overcoming. And so he has these images of ascension. So Zarathustra is on the mountain peak and so on. It's about being high, over man. But if you see life as a bridge, which he did, or as Jesus presumably did, between point A and point B, but one no longer believes in the knowability of point B, what's going to happen after life, nor do you know where your origin was, that's where Nietzsche existentializes the bridge, so that life is a bridge, but you're over a perilous ravine or body of water. You don't know where you've come from, you don't know where you're going, and you're terrified that you might lose your footing. That for him is life in a trajectory towards human goals, which are constantly being evolved, so that man overcomes himself in the overman, and then that overman keeps going. So that you're right, it's a sort of continuous transcendence of humanity. But every human being goes through that, or should go through that, if you follow a Nietzschean ethic. And it's very disconcerting, you know.
So he writes in The Gay Science, "The old humanity and animality, the collective primeval age, and the past of all sentient being continues to meditate love, hate, and reason in me. I have suddenly awoke in the midst of this dream, and I must dream on in order not to perish, just like the sleepwalker must dream on in order not to fall. The connectedness of all branches of knowledge is the best means for maintaining the universality of the dreaming, and thereby the continuation of the dream."
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost like finding yourself, it reminds me of Emerson, actually. I'm quite convinced that he had Emerson's essay Experience in mind when Emerson says, "We awake and find ourselves on a stair. We don't know how we got there,
mm-hmm.
and we find ourselves in a series of which we do not know the extremes."
Right.
And that the oblivion, somehow we got into this world, and we had to drink a cup of lethe in order to forget, and therefore we're in a dream state, and we just keep dreaming in order not to fall. And this is also related to Nietzsche's experience at Venice, a city that he really loved and found to be a city of dreams in many ways, certainly a city of music. And you reference his beautiful poem about Venice that he published in Ecce Homo, or included in his book Ecce Homo, but that's a poem about him being on a bridge in Venice and hearing a song come from afar,
mm-hmm.
and it's a response to the gondola song, and he sang silently, secretly to himself, his own gondola song in the invisible realm, maybe the unheard realm of the soul, and then he asked, "Did anyone hear it?" A lot of bridging taking place there. And he also refers to, I don't have the quote underhand, about Venice being a manifold of solitudes, multiplication of solitudes,
yeah,
that are connected, you know, with all these bridges. No, it's like a figure of our human condition where we're separate, and yet because we are ontologically separate, we do have channels of communication with
Yeah, he says it's an image for future humanity where 100,000 souls are, you know, together, but future humanity. And since his self on the bridge is solitary and he hears the song of another, of a gondolier, and sings a song back, the Nietzschean self is always in relation, but in these multiple solitudes, which he felt the future of politics needed to make possible, that is, a collectivity of individuals, as opposed to what you called homogenization before, where the differences are leveled out, so that these solitudes would be bridged. They would be monological in essence, but the monologues would be in dialogue. So it's a fantastic sort of parable that he gets from Venice. It's got multiple bridges, and you can't see much. You hear all these single voices, so it's quite beautiful.
Not only individuals, I imagine he probably even had a political vision of nations preserving a certain degree of their own, you know, particularity and diversity, but being in relation. No, of course, we're living right in the midst of this whole fault line between, you know, the globalists and the reactions and the Brexiteers and so forth. But I know that this idea of Venice as this collection, it reminds one of the archipelago, no?
Yeah, exactly. That's the image that Venice's two-time mayor, Massimo Cacciari, the philosopher king, if you will, used that image of the archipelago as an image for the union of Europe, whereby these different countries would be seen as islands and connected by the sea.
Yeah.
The sea, which in Greek, in any case, comes from bridge, is the pontos, and the pons is the bridge. So, on the other hand, Nietzsche was opposed to the state, and he satirizes the state. So I don't know that he liked the idea of nation-states as much as he might have preferred even a more postmodern collectivity,
right,
where, you know, the citizens are individualized. And
in fact, it's a very interesting quote from Nietzsche that you invoke, where the state ceases, there the unsuperfluous person begins. There the song of necessity begins, Where the state ceases, look there, my brothers, do you not see them? The rainbow and bridges to the more than man.
Right. So the liberation of the self from the state makes that self necessary or unsuperfluous, and that individual can become an individual as opposed to a conformist, right? The sheep, everyone's the same as everyone else. And then you can have bridges and rainbows to the overman or the more than man. Humanity can get about its business better that way.
Right. I'd like to take just a few moments to talk about people living on bridges, mm-hmm. because that's there's something paradoxical, there's something problematic there. No, and you have a whole chapter devoted to inhabited bridges, almost as if it were a paradox, because you're not supposed to live on a bridge, no?
Right, right.
So why do you devote so many pages to these bridges that are actually places of human habitation?
Well, again, I guess I do it because I see that the terminals of A and B, beginning and end, have always been unclear to everybody. So at a certain point, you say, okay, well, let's make the best of life on this bridge. And sure enough, people live around rivers and waters, and they cross them, and then they build on top of them. So you get this paradoxical situation of the fixity on top of the flux. And you have these covered bridges, Ponte Vecchio. London Bridge was, I don't know how many hundreds of people lived on it. It was had massive buildings.
Were they on it or under it?
No, they were on it. They were on it. I have an illustration in the book of London Bridge in 1700s. And then people would live under them. You know, the houseless, the homeless, would take refuge under the bridge. So the bridge becomes a place of those who are not socially taken care of, including prostitutes. So the lonely go to bridges. Some jump off, obviously, but some hook up with prostitutes. Many of them live there under. And so the bridge has got this sanctifying effect, you know, for the transience and precarity of life. So that's why I was actually surprised to learn how many bridges are inhabited.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And only lately they started demolishing them, taking off the structures.
So just to your last chapter, since we're getting to the end of our time, so what sort of conclusion do you come to, and is there something that, we've talked a lot about the various existential, political, and cultural aspects of it, but phenomenologically speaking, I would expect that the highest ambition of a book, of any kind of book, is to make you see something very differently after you've read it, no?
Mm-hmm.
So do you see bridges, and would you expect your readers to see physical bridges, that they would reveal themselves phenomenologically and differently than beforehand?
Well, yeah, that's exactly my goal, and also to give as many associations to these bridges as possible, you know, so that one sees... One normally doesn't think about the lands that are united by a bridge. So you look at a bridge, you say, oh, it's a nice bridge, if it is indeed nice. But you don't think about the lands that it unifies, the waters that separate the lands, the way life used to be, where people on different sides of a river might have very different cultures, for that matter. Sometimes right. Buda and Pest, or some of the rivers, as you mentioned, Indrina, which would separate cultures. In Ireland, Northern Ireland, there's stories about Protestants on one side and Catholics on the other. So one of my goals, I couldn't unify all the meanings and associations of bridges because there's literally hundreds, but was to make us mindful of the division and the differences, which are precisely what makes life so rich, and therefore to appreciate these differences and the way we are in control of connecting them, but also how that control can be dangerous if we're not mindful of what we're doing. So we don't want to erase difference. On the contrary, I would like to see a world where all the differences are preserved, and then one can bridge them, or one can choose also not to.
Right.
But the bridging is our doing.
So finally, this goes back to the question of style, because your book clearly is not a typical academic book that is targeted to a you know, specialized audience, like a handful of people or at most 100 or 200 you know, fellow specialists of your field, but is seems to open itself up to a broader readership inside and outside of the academy. And that, do you also aspire, did you aspire to enact the bridging dynamic in the way that you wrote the book?
Well, I did, and I even worried that it's not going to have any clearly defined audience at all, so that a publisher wouldn't even know how to market it. Fortunately, University of Chicago Press said they're going to market it precisely to general public, because it's all over the place, both historically from, you know, many centuries before, you know, Jesus, as well as geographically from China and Japan to South America. So the readers I'm aware of, having read it so far, almost all are non-academic. And I think, despite the fact that it's a little bit demanding, they get through it because each of those little stories is interesting in itself. And so you get 2, 3, 4 pages on one story, then another, and yet they're unified in the theme that the chapter is focused on. So, yeah, it's a kind of more than a, it's maybe more of a labyrinth than a bridge, the book, or it's just, there's so many bridges being cast that one makes of them what one will.
I would define the genre as kaleidoscopic.
Yeah.
It's a kaleidoscope of bridges. And sometimes it can be dizzying because there are so many and simultaneously one adjacent to the other in very close proximity. Kaleidoscopic or even psychedelic, is if you prefer. But I think kaleidoscopic is the word that I would favor. So we're going to leave our audience with the Jimi Hendrix song that we started out referencing, namely Bold as Love from the album Axis Bold as Love. Is there anything that you would invite them to pay particular attention to as we play it to end our show?
Well, the last time I looked at it, I was struck by the fact that he personifies each of these 7 colors, which are unusual colors for that matter, not the normal ones of the rainbow, purple and yellow and so on. And each one of these seems to have an inimical, that is, there's a war going on. And these are, you know, the Mars is and envy and so on and so forth. And love is not one of them. And he says that one can be, he wants to be as bold as love, but these colors within him, which are stopping him from giving himself to presumably this woman he has in mind.
A rainbow like you, she calls her.
He wants to be able to, but he has to be as bold of as love, as the axis of love. So it's as if these colors are working against that unity. Mm-hmm. That's one reading. I don't know. I haven't studied it online, as one tends to do nowadays.
Well, then we'll just invite every listener to study it themselves and let it resound in that invisible realm that gets bridged every time music, you know, produces those sounds.
And to produce a rainbow in them.
Exactly. So we've been speaking with Thomas Harrison, author of Bridges, a Poetic and Philosophical Account, here on Entitled Opinions. Thanks for listening, and here we go with Jimi Hendrix, Bold as Love.
Anger, he smiles, towering in shiny metallic purple armor. Queen jealousy, envy waits behind him. Her fiery green gown sneers at the grassy ground. Blue are the life-giving waters, taken for granted. They quietly understand. Once happy turquoise armies lay opposite ready, but wonder why the fight is on. But they're all bold as love. Yeah. They're all bold as love. Yeah. They're all bold as love. Just ask the axis. My red is so confident he flashes trophies of war. And ribbons of euphoria. Orange is young, full of daring, but very unsteady for the first go round. My yellow in this case is not so mellow. In fact, I'm trying to say it's frightened like me. And all of these emotions of mine keep tolling me from giving my life to a rainbow like you. But I'm a, yeah, I'm old as love. Yeah, yeah. The answers, he knows everything.